must cause confusion and delay.
You have caused
confusion and delay.
I think you are facing prejudice.
Daisy is just the ultimate thought. Daisy is just the ultimate thought.
Your impatience has caused confusion and delay. This storm has caused confusion and delay. You are causing confusion and delay. You caused confusion and delay.
26 years old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Been great today.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to The Deepest Law. I still think that theme music is too jolly. I think there's too much jolliness and banter in the intro, but welcome to The Deepest Law. I'm joined today by a special guest, Professor Ed Dutton, also known as the Jolly Heretic. How are you doing, sir?
I'm okay, yeah, and I was just transported back in time to being 14 or 15 years old when I first watched that and first laughed out loud at that. So that's cheered me up. I actually wrote to Richard Herring once and told him the positive effect he had had, he more so than Stuart Lee, perhaps even, on my teenage years. I did one of my first academic papers was on swearing in evangelical Christian groups, and they used this phrase "pants." Christians would say something was "pants" to a much greater extent than normal people would, a disguised swearing. And there's a line of Richard Herring's where he says, "If you think a circular saw in that man's pants, if you think that's funny, you're sick. Pants are funny, but not with a circular saw in them." And I wrote to him about this. So that was good fun. That was good fun to see. How are you doing?
I think Richard Herring, correct me if I'm wrong, I think Richard Herring's father was a reverend, like a vicar.
I've got the impression he was a school headmaster.
A school headmaster who was also quite religious, something like that.
That's the impression I get. I get the impression his background was quite religious and that his father was the headmaster of the secondary school that he went to.
Right. Yeah, I seem to remember now. He had a show called The Headmaster's Son, which I went to once, where he talked about it.
That's it. Yeah. Headmaster's Son.
I will just remind people, do buy my courses at the academic agency. I'd recommend picking up the Trivium first, Foundations of Writing, then go on to do the Logic and the Rhetoric, or many other courses are available as well. But just before we get going, Ed, anything you'd like to promote, sir?
Can I plug my equivalent of the Dissenting Academy?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Which is my Jolly Heretic Substack. So www.jollyheretic.com, and that's my Substack where you can be a subscriber to my Substack, which would be most vitally helpful, and that's where I put all of the spiciest content that our mutant overlords on YouTube will not allow, and also in-person interviews and vlogs I'm doing these days and documentaries and all kinds of stuff and the more based videos, and that's all exclusive to my Substack subscribers. So go on over to Substack and jollyheretic.com, and I'll see you there behind the bar.
Fantastic. Now, we're going to be talking about, I've already tried to do one stream on Stuart Lee, but unfortunately I was planning on doing like a kind of, I tried to do a solo stream, Ed, where I was doing kind of live analysis of the snippets of his shows. But unfortunately the BBC didn't like that and kept on, you know, sniping it for copyright reasons. As far as I know, it's still up, but I lost patience because
I saw some of it at the time. But what is it that you find so extraordinary then? Because we haven't really actually talked about this until now. Like, what is it you find so extraordinary?
I mean, after I did that stream, you got in touch and you said, "Oh, I'm a big Stuart Lee fan as well." And I thought, well, what are the odds of that? I mean, why did I ask you, Ed? What you mentioned that you started watching, I assume it was Fist of Fun, and then This Morning with Richard and Not Judy back when you were a teenager. I also started watching them back then. I remember it well. It was on, I think it was on Thursday nights. I can't remember the exact, I think it was on Thursday nights, where it would be The Far Show followed by Fist of Fun. And that was my little double bill of comedy. And I'd go through the TV guide and I would circle it, and I would always Do you ever remember doing that? I'd circle it on the TV guide.
Telegraph TV guide. I
would let people know, on this time, Thursday night, I'm not going out. I'm not seeing anyone. I'd let my parents know. I have to have the TV for that time. And that was it. That was my little ritual every week.
Maybe my family was less middle class than yours. I had a TV in my room. So I didn't have to share the TV. If I didn't want to watch whatever my parents were watching at that time with them, I'd just go upstairs and watch it upstairs and record it. I mean, I watched the first episode of Fist of Fun, and then thereafter I would tape it.
In fact, there was a very good reason to tape it, because they used to do those quick hit things.
Those little quick things. And I actually I paused them, and I'll tell you about it later. And I wrote to Stuart Lee about one of these things, and he wrote back. And I've got the postcard somewhere at my parents' house. But there was just something about it immediately. A couple of years earlier, and of course there were comparisons to it, and they'd talk about these comparisons. We're talking 92. Mm-hmm. There was the Mary Whitehouse experience.
I watched that as well. Yeah, I used to watch that.
And this was great. And this was, of course, this eventually split up to be Newman and Badil, who were very funny and were the more kind of intellectual component of it. And then the other two, Punt and Dennis, who were less funny and who were the less intellectual component of it. And I thought that Lee and Herring kind of combined the best of both. So they weren't too sort of intellectual and obscure. Like there was the more the Herring stuff really was more sort of cheeky and jolly, and that was his persona anyway, to be this sort of Herring cheeky character. And then the Lee stuff was more the sort of intellectualized meta comedy even then. But I just thought it just worked so well. And as a teenager, when you're kind of, you know, born in 1980 or whatever, early 80s, you're in that Daria mode anyway that you've talked about, I think.
Yes.
Everyone else is going around listening to Blur. Or 94, maybe that's a bit early for Blur. Was it 94, 95? So
they were around. Blur were around, I remember.
Oasis, Ocean Colour Scene, Jarvis Cocker, all this bollocks. I'm a bit outside that, and I'm into Lee and Herring, and they were obscure. They were by the standards of this sort of stuff. It was BBC Two rather than BBC One. It was relatively late at night. It was the middle of the week. They were Thursday, I think you're right in saying. And it was this obscurity to it, this cultness to it, and just very quickly the surrealism of the sketches just took off.
I was going to say as well that I think that there was a bit of a sea change in British alternative comedy around this time that we're talking about, because I never liked the 1980s political alternative comedians like the Ben Eltons or the Alexei Sayles. Like they were all like preachy and anti-Thatcher, and I was never into that. They just weren't funny. But around this time that we're talking about, I would say that there was a kind of renaissance, if you want, of slightly more surreal or absurdist comedy, because you also had Harry Hill, who had a very strange Channel 4 show called The Harry Hill Show, which I kind of enjoyed. There was Reeves and Mortimer, who were, I mean, if you go back and watch their material from this time, they were extremely surreal and kind of had like absurdist elements as well. Lee and Herring had a friend whose name I forget now. He actually appeared on various shows of theirs, who went on to have an even more obscure show, which was on a UK player. I forget that guy's name now. Simon
Simon Quinlank.
Not Simon Quinlank. He was like a kind of, he had like a cane, and he had a, he went around doing like this rather obscure quiz show. I forgot what the name of that thing is now.
Maybe Simon Mallory.
That's it. Yeah, the him.
Now I saw him live. I saw him live at the Edinburgh Festival in 1999, on the basis, which is the first Edinburgh Festival I ever went to, on the basis of his connection with Lee and Herring, and he really was rather disappointing. And it was all of the deadpanness of Stuart Lee. It was the deadpan persona that Stuart Lee, well, he varies the persona he goes for, doesn't he? But it was the deadpan persona that he generally goes for, but without really that much in the way of jokes. It was just being deadpan and saying sort of sort of mildly offensive things about certain groups or whatever, but without any, it wasn't actually funny. I was shocked by that. He wasn't, I don't know what's happened to him, but he was not that.
Yeah, he was, I mean, he wasn't the best. I'm just saying he was kind of, if I was to try to outline who some of these more surreal comedians were, he would, I think he did a show called Attention Scum or.
Yeah, that's
like
right.
This. It was like that's a right. kind of game show thing. He's part of that kind of thing. And for me, I was always more into slightly more surreal humor of, you know, along the lines of it, any of these acts that we're talking about, of which by far my favorite were Lee and Herring. I thought they were the cleverest.
What I thought was particularly interesting in terms of this change, what you're saying with the 80s, with Ben Elton and Alexis Sale and whatever, is that their, as you say, their style of comedy was quite morally didactic and it was quite aggressive. And I think that you see elements of that in the Young Ones as well, which was highly surreal. Because Alexis Sale was given his own little part in the Young Ones where he could soliloquize. But with the Young Ones, then you have this subtle development from that into Filthy Rich and Cat Flap, and then of course Bottom, where it strikes me that the characters are more and more sort of childlike. They're basically people that haven't grown up. They're looking at, they're adults, but they're kind of psychologically children. They're looking at the world as children, and you have this phenomenon that Richie, of course, is a virgin. Eddie is. Well, he's not a virgin, but it's two guys living together, and they're meant to be what, about in their late 30s or something, and they're still living together in a flat share. And it's this arrested development that they haven't quite grown up. And I think as you move into the 90s, you get more and more of the cult of youth, you know, Blair mania, this idea that it's a bad thing to grow up. And I think what you see with the Lee and Herring characters, particularly the Herring character, is the Rod Hull character, which they developed in the second series. I think it was only the second series, that you don't grow up. You remain with this childlike perspective on the world. I mean, even with Rod Hull, he's like, "Ow, my BCG." That's of course something that you get for our American viewers. You know, when you're 14 years old, it's this inoculation that you get, and it leaves a bump, an unpleasant bump for up, you know, maybe even years, and people poke you and it hurts. And so I think that they were different from a slightly earlier comedians that were born in maybe the late 50s or early 60s, like Lee and Herring, sorry, like Newman and Baddiel, is that there's this deliberate childishness to them, which I think worked incredibly well.
Yeah, and I do think as well, now that I think of that era that you're talking about, that we're talking about here, is that there was also a very strong, what you might call a mainstream culture that they could bounce off as well, right? And in fact, in their This Morning with Richard Not Judy days, they occasionally clashed with it because they kept on, an ongoing joke is that they kept on moving This Morning for the sport or for the cricket or whatever. And that was like an ongoing joke. But there, if you remember in the late 90s, there was a very strong mainstream lad culture, like, you know, The Men Behaving Badly, or, you know, you go and watch shows from that period, and it's a strong kind of pub culture and lad culture that was around, and that was very broadly speaking dominant, I would say, when I was a teenager. And so in that kind of social and cultural milieu, you could say, Lee and Herring also offered something a bit different as well.
There's still the fag end of almost a traditional culture to slightly rebel against. So you have the people that were running the country back then were born in the 1930s and 1940s, mostly before the war. And you have basically one national culture, as you say, this kind of lad culture. I think it's presented very well, actually, in a sitcom, which is no one really remembers these days, called Game On. Remember that?
Yes, yeah. Game On. I remember that.
No one really remembers it, but that was to me, that was just the essence, the epitome of sort of mid-1990s culture.
I actually did a stream once on this show on Deepest Lore on 90s lad culture, where we watched and analysed some of an episode of Game on that show. I kind of like it for dark reasons. I like the kind of dark bullying element of that show. Yeah, it very neatly shows what the kind of mainstream culture
and
was
that just,
of that
period. That just was the culture. And the idea now that I've become more and more aware of as I've got older, and I'm, you know, in my early 40s, and I meet these people that are in their early 20s, and it's amazing, you know, this kind of based subculture that seems to exist. All of these warring microcosms, one of which is very right-wing and very conservative and so forth, and, you know, traditionally religious and all this kind of stuff. And this is through the internet that this is able to develop and take off. And there was people that are watching that are in their 20s. There was nothing like that. There was the phone book. That was it. And there was just, you didn't deviate from what everybody else did. You literally couldn't. And so the extent to, there was no, how could you meet someone that would disagree? You wouldn't meet such people. So to the extent that you could do anything, there would be these it would be within television or within radio if you listened to that. Very few people did, and that was Lee and Herring was this modest, obscure rebellion in a sort of slightly Pythonesque, surreal way.
And so there was one other thing I liked about it, Ed, as well, which is that it's very much felt like a show that was on the edges or the fringes of what the BBC had control over or what was acceptable. It's like, it was almost like these two guys had been given, like, well, here's 30 minutes of TV to fill, do what you want. And I don't think you'd see that so much these days. There's a much more strong sense of central control on everything now, I would say.
Yes, well, that's because the BBC is not in a position of strength. I think they're increasingly in a position where they're under attack. And also they're increasingly taken over to such an extreme degree by basically woke ideologues and that sort of thing, that there just wouldn't be the social trust almost necessary to allow two people in there. Well, they were only in their sort of mid to late 20s, I think, when it was the first series of Lee and Herring. And maybe they were 26 years old. 26 years old I was. Then I got off the bus. They were only relatively young, and they were just allowed to just do whatever they liked. And some of the stuff, I mean, a sketch I particularly loved was the one about a pie festival in Shrewsbury, and how they it was obviously a satire, an ostentatious, over the top, anachronistic satire of English conservatism and, you know, Brexit, proto Brexit voters, really. And it's this idea that in Shrewsbury, they go around collecting the remnants of the previous year's pies, and they put them all together into one great big pie. And then every 10 years, they collect the previous year's pies plus the previous year's pies, and then the previous pie pies. And they're a part of the pie that are over 500 years old. And there's a bit where this guy says, "Only what I like. If I want to eat soil, I'll eat it. If I want to eat glass, English glass, I'll eat it. I didn't fight in World War II. If I had, I wouldn't let it happen. Screw you, Dolores. Screw your ass." Like this. And it was the brilliant surrealness of it. And you know that it's the BBC are only just, as you say, only just about tolerating this. And this one, which not Judy, even more so, because, of course, that was on in the middle of the day. That would start at midday sometimes. And yet they would have ribald humour and mocking religion. And some of the best stuff in that, in my view, was The Unusual Priest, which was this guy, the actor Kevin Eldon, and sort of highly sexual stuff and whatever in the middle of the day. So it's almost like by then, this is, I think, 1997 or 8, the BBC just didn't care. They just let them do it.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of some of my favourite bits from that, you know, from the Lee and Herring era. I liked, I loved the deconstruction of the prodigal son.
Oh yeah,
like
yeah.
That's kind of a good one. I like Men of Achievement, 1974.
That was completely random and strange. Yeah, that was very, very good. When Stuart Lee gets a girlfriend and it's a kitten. That was
The Robbie Williams tattoo. Tattoo.
I don't remember that. And the driving instructor. I wonder, actually, how much of the Lee and Herring stuff that we liked was actually Herring. Because for example, the driving instructor sketch, which was absolutely brilliant. You know, my name is Peter Dibden, I'm a driving instructor, blah, blah, blah. That you showed at the beginning. That's definitely Herring. And there were a number of other characters like that that were certainly Herring being the childlike funny one. He's meant to be 30 years old or something like this. He still does things like gets Kinder eggs so he can collect the plastic toy that you can make therein. And he assumes the reason why China might bomb Taiwan is because it's where they make all of the toys that go inside Kinder eggs. And so you're confusing your motives with those of world leaders. the sick man, the whole real sick man thing.
Who's the real sick man? Yeah.
Who's the real sick man? Yeah. I mean, I don't know if on YouTube I can even repeat some of the sketches that he compares. And the milk, of course, and the liking different
the
kinds milk. Of milk.
Yeah, that's very herring, the milk.
That's very herring. Again, I saw them live at the Riverside Studios in Hammersmith. And that was where they were. That was the milks and the cress thing. That was part of that. I saw them live at the Tarumrunja. This was at the Richmond, the theatre in Richmond, Orange Tree, and then I saw them live at Guildford.
Wow! And you saw them three times.
Something of a fan, and then I saw Herring live at Edinburgh at least once. I think it might have been the one about being 40 or Christ on a Bike. If it was Christ on a Bike. And then I saw Lee live, I think, twice at the Edinburgh Festival. I chatted to him at the bar and stuff. So, whereas with Herring, I didn't have so much of a conversation. With Lee, I had more of a conversation. I have to admit, I was a fan. The interesting thing, well, one thing, I wasn't sure when we were going to start this and what we would exactly discuss. But one thing that interested me in terms of his character, Lee, is that when I wrote, one of the times I paused the Lee and Herring, having recorded it, was that he'd mentioned some sort of society of atheists, mm-hmm. Something along those lines. And it was the British Humanist UK, and it was this British secular society. That's what he was talking about. And this was after one of the sketches about the prodigal son or whatever, I suppose. And I didn't remember what it was. I couldn't find it. So in the end, I just wrote to him and said, you mentioned in your... in your show, this society of atheists. And at the time, I went to a religious school, so you know my way of being rebellious was to be an atheist and all this. Can you tell me about it? And he wrote back and he sent me a load of their magazines. And he said, well, yeah, this is what I was talking about. But to be perfectly honest with you, they are as bigoted and as blinkered as those they condemn. That's what he said.
Interesting. Yeah.
Age 28, and I've got that postcard somewhere. Something words along those lines. They're as bigoted, or they're as black and white, or whatever, as those they condemn. That's what he said. And then that was when he was 28 or 29. And now he is one of the patrons of the British Secular Society and of the Humanist UK. So you can see how across time, often people will become less black and white, more nuanced in their views. But it's as though as he's had to decide what side he will take in an increasingly acrimonious culture war, he's plumbed for obviously the left and for mm-hmm. atheism. And so he's gone from saying these people are as bad as those they condemn when he's 28 to in his 50s or whatever he is, late 50s, being a patron of these exact same people.
Interesting.
So I thought that was an interesting insight into the nature of the man.
Very interesting. I mean, just before we move on from Lee and Herring to just Lee himself, I'm just trying to think of some other little bits that are... I liked that whole... Hi, I'm Greg Evigan. When things get knocked over, spill and fall out of cupboards. One of the things I like about a lot of their stuff and a lot of Lee's stuff is that a joke will build over time, or that, you know, something that is initially... quite weak, they just stick with it week in, week out. So by
there's one of the sketches, isn't there, one of the early ones about the boy who cried wolf, and yes. he keeps crying wolf, and it's funny the first time for everybody, but apart from the baker or something who says no, that the blacksmith, my forge would have gone dry now, would have burnt out now, I've lost the day's work. So, you know, don't do it again. He's like, okay, I won't do it again. And he does it again. And then still the baker or the blacksmith, also still finds it funny. He goes, no, it's not funny a second time. It was funny the first time, not a second time. And the baker says, no, I think it's funnier. And so it carries on. And then even the third time, the baker still thinks it's slightly funny. And he goes, no, I think the baker does think it's funny, but he's suppressing it because he's afraid you're gonna hit him. No, look, humor is a subjective concept. You've not listened to a word I just said. And it's just the idea there, talking about just a weak joke of just lying and saying, oh, there's a wolf, and getting the whole village to come, and then just keep doing it. No, I think it's for me, the humour comes, and the repetitiveness of it, the very fact of the repetition, that for me, that makes it even funnier. And then eventually he just punches him in the stomach and he loses his job. That's an example of the taking a weak joke. Or just taking, I like the childlike mishearing. So I am the lord of the dance, said he, yes. As opposed to said he. And I recall that as a five-year-old hearing it as settee and thinking exactly the same thing and just running, just making it. They talk about it. That's the meta comedy. You've made 5 minutes of material out of a childish mishearing of a word.
They combine some of those things with some of the, I mean, if you think of the reoccurring joke of Nostradamus gets one of his predictions wrong. And then has to have a Chinese burn as the punishment.
Yes.
And then the payoff is that really Nostradamus is a bit kinky and kind of likes it.
It's a woman.
It's a woman, and the leg is, and the Chinese burn is on a. He's got like fake legs on that horse, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway. Well, one of the, there are numerous different things that Stuart Lee does really well, if we want to get onto him and why I like him. One of the through lines, other than the repetition, something repeated enough times then somehow comes out the other side and becomes funny, is the deconstruction of comedy that he does. And that is something that is very much there, even in the Lee and Herring stuff. Do you remember they do that alternative history thing where they've got comedians with mugs? They've always got like an SDP mug, I think it is, and they're talking about various bits from comedy history and so on. But they also, like, if you pay attention to what is being said there, he is constantly making fun of kind of comedy tropes and deconstructing comedy, which is something that never quite goes away. And in his stand-up, what Lee constantly does is that the show deconstructs itself even as it's happening, which always puts his, I mean, Lee is very left-wing, like he's militantly left-wing, right? But he is self-aware enough to when he's on stage also to poke fun of that and to draw attention to it. Like, I was watching one of his recent shows, Tornado, just before we came on, because I hadn't seen that he's done a couple of shows that I haven't seen more recently. And there's this whole reoccurring thing where he tries to make a deal of the fact that he was called the number one comedian in the world in the Times and given a 5-star review, but that he doesn't really care about that. But then he keeps on coming back to it again and again. And Dave Chappelle comes up as a character in that show.
I think that's an example of sort of just many a true word said in jest. I think that's an example. It's almost like the Jimmy Savile idea of doing something in plain sight. I wonder if actually what we're dealing with is someone who, in some ways, I mean, if you look at the psychology of the comedian, I think you're dealing with the contradictions of the man, and the cognitive dissonances of the man, and the traumas of the man, really. And I think there's some ways in which he's just being honest, but then he has sort of plausible deniability because he's doing it in a comedic context, and so exactly we're sitting here saying, oh well, is he? We can never quite know.
There's a moment in that show though where he imagines a scenario where he doesn't turn up for a gig for some reason and it's just an empty stage, and he then imagines the 5-star Guardian review that the Guardian journalist would write about how clever his show where he doesn't turn up for it for 2 hours would be. So you can, like, he is kind of aware. Another thing I did Ed, is I went and watched like a number of interviews that he's done on like very minor podcasts and YouTube channels and things like that, just to hear what he's like when he's out of character and so on. And one of the things I didn't realize is that, you know, he has his Guardian column.
Mm-hmm.
I had always assumed that his Guardian column was just straight up. But listening to him talk about it, he talks about his Guardian column as a performance piece and as the writer of that Guardian column not really being him as well. And I actually wonder if this is so far gone with Stuart Lee that he's no longer actually aware of what is real and what is not.
Well, I was aware of that, and I've seen him say things like that. I don't know if you've read his novel. Have you read his novel?
No, I haven't. I haven't read his novel.
It's a terrible novel, but it's worth reading for a kind of an insight into it. But I mean, if you look at there's an interesting paper on this, on the psychology of very successful comedians, called Psychotic Traits in Comedians. And what it found is that they're marked by really two key things. One is, to a significant extent, above normal actors or just other performers or whatever, manic depression and what you either will call them schizoid or autistic traits.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that they experience everything more strongly than normal people, which means it's much more intense. And so they kind of have a desire to make sense of it, to understand it, they're experiencing more. So they're noticing perhaps more subtle things that normal people wouldn't notice, to the extent of psychosis. So to the extent of having visions and of being out of touch with reality for periods of time. So this, of course, autism is going to mean that they're going to notice details. They're going to feel like outsiders. Equally, the schizoid traits crosses over with autism a bit. Likewise, they're going to notice details. They're going to feel like outsiders. Sometimes they've been noted to be quite emotionally flat, which is congruous with schizoid traits. They're going to see their brains are going to be unusual simply because they have these autism or schizoid traits. So they're going to make unusual connections. They're going to see things in odd ways. They're going to develop unusual metaphors, which normal people wouldn't do. From thence, the humor arose. They're going to feel like outsiders. The manic depression and indeed just being autistic or schizoid will mean periods of deep unhappiness, of basically a poor sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
Because what a self is about is that you understand the world kind of makes sense, and this is you, and this is where you are in it, and this is you in relation to others. And if you're high in autism or schizoid traits, then you're overwhelmed by these very strong feelings, and the world is just this chaos, and you just don't. It's harder to develop a clear sense of who you are, because nothing really makes any sense, because it's so overwhelming, it's so intense for you that you can't really stop to orient yourself. So you feel like an outsider, poor sense of self. This can give people the desire for laughter, because at least in the moment of laughter, you know that you're controlling people and things are making sense, and you're in control, and others, you know, kind of like you. And they also notice an emotional flatness, a detachment to them, a detachment from reality, which is consistent, again, with the ability to look as an outsider from things. Mm-hmm. But the most interesting, I thought, was the introversion, extroversion thing. So normally it just found that actors are just high in extroversion, simple as that. They feel positive feelings strongly. They like acting. They're performing. People looking at them saying they're brilliant. It gives them a rush. That's acting. With these people, they were high in extroverted impulsiveness. So they're low impulse, they're impulsive people. But they're also high in introverted anhedonia, which means they don't experience positive feelings strongly.
Mm.
So you've got this weird contradiction whereby you're going to have people that are probably going to be extroverts on stage, but much more introvert in their everyday life. And that was what the psychology, autism and manic depression. So the manic depression means that you have these incredible highs, these incredible lows, but you experience the world much more intensively. And so if we look at what we're going to expect this guy to be like, he's obviously highly intelligent, and intelligence is strongly genetic, but he's born to a single mother who had to give him up. So this would be consistent with intelligence plus basically sort of psychopathic traits, really, which includes aspects of autism or whatever. That would be consistent with that. His parents then broke up when he was about, his adoptive parents, when he was about three. Mm. And he was raised by a single mother. So, and he talks about in some of his interviews how his father just became this wreck. And he would go there and his father would just be sitting there in his pants, you know, embarrassing. I think the Greg Egan, some of the Greg Egan sketches are about this, about a single dad who's just this, a weekend dad who's just this slob. And the child goes to see him and gets stung by a bee. And he's talking about, oh, that's just the kind of ammunition she wants to stop me seeing her and all this kind of stuff. I think he draws on this kind of stuff. So you've got the trauma of that elevates things like depression and schizoid traits. Then you've got that he goes through school on a part scholarship, private school, because he's adopted. He gets ulcerative colitis as a teenager. Imagine the agony and pain of that, right? And also he goes through various stages of unemployment where his world is chaos. After they finished Turumrunger, that happened. After Jerry Springer, the opera, that happened. And then you've got this movement, as I say, from being sceptical of everything, really, or seeming so, to fully joining the left, and this idea. So I think there's this kind of tension within him between being this sort of shaman, this shaman outsider who is deadpan and who is signaling how skeptical he is, with a desire to be part of the establishment and to have adoration. And that pendulum swings back and forth. He even said this. So there was a period in about 06 when he was, after Jerry Springer the Opera was cancelled, that he was so desperate for money that he became one of those, those panel show comedians. Mm-hmm. That whole class of comedians, the David Mitchell, that there's like a class of them, that this is the same people, and they all write biographies when they're in their early 40s or whatever, and all this, these kinds of people. And he got drawn into that. And then he said he felt disgusted by this because he always felt, no, he was an outsider to this normal comedy. And so he felt really bad that he did that. And you've got this thing like, he's obviously very successful, but he continues to live in this small little flat in Stoke Newington. So you've got these fascinating sort of contradictions that he's living out. And I think you see this in the comedy. So the persona, on the one hand, hates change and goes on about it. Oh, there's too many young people here. All the young people. I remember we had to get records and we had to, and the curmudgeon, the skeptic, who's intelligent. On the other hand, he has to balance that with being right on with, Brexit, people that vote Brexit are, whatever. And with the mental breakdowns that he does on stage, which I strongly suspect are rooted in things that have happened to him. I think it's like he's living out these contradictions on stage. That's how I thought.
Very interesting. Yeah, I mean, there are. One of the things I have noticed is that, despite his left wingery, there is definitely, there is a tradition of comedy, and a sense of Englishness or Britishness and of local identities that he strongly identified. Like when you cut away all the bullshit, there are clearly things that he holds extremely dear, and they come through very strongly both in the interviews and also on, like, some of the people he talks about, the comedians he admires and so on, he has genuine affection for, like genuine affection. In a way that doesn't come through as strongly, where he's just simply mouthing kind of right on platitudes and so on. And this is another kind of interesting contradiction, because he doesn't allow himself to be patriotic, because he's left wing. But you can also see that yearning for a connection and belonging to this kind of tradition that he sees himself as part of. Somebody like Alan Bennett, he's a reoccurring character in this show I watched earlier on, but you can tell that there's something about Alan Bennett and what he stands for and what he is, and where he's from, and that sort of that sort of figure, basically, that he, like, I think genuinely, like, the real Stuart Lee finds an authenticity in that in a way, and he holds on to it.
Which was the stand-up comedy one where, that painting, is it the Wonder, what's it called, where there's the man looking out over the mountain and you see him from behind, that famous painting? It's in the background of for the whole time of one of his stand-up routines, and then eventually he starts criticizing the concept of the selfie. And he makes it, we turned it around. Now, rather than looking at the beautiful reality, we want a selfie of ourselves in front of it. And I thought that was brilliant, the way he built up to that. And so there is some sort of genuine nostalgia, or that he sees himself as the philosopher type who sees things more deeply than, well, most of the scum, basically. As he probably sees them. He sees himself as the constant skeptical outsider in a world of idiots. And you, even in the very early stuff, like I remember when I was first watching Ian Herring, I discovered that, well, they've been on Radio 2 or 4, I forget which, before, and you could get it on tape. So I got a lot of it was repeated sketches. So I got a lot of their stuff on tape. And there was one sketch about he runs into a police officer and he's speeding or something. And he says, "That's very good. Are you some sort of comedian, sir?" says the police officer. He goes, "Yes, I am a comedian. That's very astute of you, officer. Yes, I am a comedian. I am a stand-up comedian. That is the kind of comedian I am." And this idea, it so fits in with the way you feel when you're arrogant and you're 14 or 15 years old and you think that you're cleverer than all the stupid adults. And it's so fit the comedian, the Socrates, the person that stands outside things, and I think he has that. But he also does talk about the nostalgia for really just his childhood. I mean, the 70s, mm-hmm. the idea of going to a record shop and buying a record, and the records and the record collection you have being part of your identity. So and so will like that. I'll buy him that. How that's all gone. Every hobby was something you really invested in, and you invested a lot of time in it, and it was kind of part of who you are. And now it's just anything, you know. I remember when I was about 13, I started tracing my family tree. Nobody else did that. And you had to go in person to St. Catherine's House in London. Mm-hmm. And it was a long slog and it involved money and time, and you had to really be into it. Whereas now everybody knows their family history. You go online, you can find out in an hour what it might take you 6 months to find out back then. And he is nostalgic for that. He's nostalgic almost for the world of Mary Mungo and Midge.
He also, I would say, has some extremely astute kind of criticisms of mass culture and mainstream consumerist culture that, broadly speaking, a lot of people would agree with. Where that's coming from is another question, but he does, when he starts to turn his gaze on bad aspects of modern life, it's quite interesting. I also watched this, one of the things I've noticed that he gets away with because he's so right on and left wing and so on, is that he often turns his opprobrium on various black celebrities. This one I watched earlier on has got a long segment where he's having a go at Dave Chappelle, because Dave Chappelle, the whole thing is that Dave Chappelle was in one of the dressing rooms at the Leicester Square Theatre, and he had requested for all the lights to be changed to be red lights, and for 2 rotisserie to chickens to be on.
Right. Yeah.
And there's a whole 10-minute bit about the fact that Dave Chappelle requested 2 rotisserie chickens to be on there, and he kind of goes on about it and on about it. And there's another one where there's that whole bit where he's talking about the So Solid crew, and he's having a look at the autobiography of the So Solid crew member. You know, the rappers who go like that. So he does, how can I say, like, in these really strange passive-aggressive ways, he draws attention to, like, degenerate and pathetic aspects of modern culture that everybody's, you know, he does draw your attention to these things, and he kind of encourages you to have a sort of slightly disgusted response to them. Obviously, without there being any explicit racial element, but I was just saying, it's interesting what he's up to. Like, what is he doing when he's drawing attention to some of these characters? Ed, do you reckon?
Yeah, I've been part of it in terms of sort of the psychology of it. He's doing, it seems to me, these are very, very successful comedians, more successful than him, So Dave Chappelle, so he's attacking them in order to promote this idea that he's the fearless outsider. Somebody earlier mocked my comparison to Socrates in your chat. I'm not saying he's like Socrates.
That's for the people to say.
you're way ahead of me. I wonder how much of it we just know off by heart. That is father's to say. But if he says that if I was Jesus, this is the kind of place I would come, isn't it? A modest, humble place, full of drunks and whores. So he's doing that. So it's a way of signalling. It's this balance that he wants to signal, which he has to get right, and he's quite successful at getting it right, I suppose. Between being the cynic, being the skeptic, being the person that is the jester character who is speaking truth to power and is mocking the powerful, including the powerful in his own scene, what he sees as powerful comedians, the more mainstream comedians that he'll have a go at, like Frankie Boyle and Michael McIntyre, who he talks about, his show, it's like warmed up diarrhea or whatever. These much more successful or more mainstream comedians than and Dave Chappelle, but then on the other hand, he has to balance that with showing his ultimate adherence to that very same power structure, to that very same system, by saying things like, "Oh, political correctness. Yeah, it's awful, isn't it? Just being fair to people. That's what he said. That's just such a he must know what a utterly simplistic." Summary of what political correctness is: it's just being fair to people, and to completely ignore the degree to which it involves speech codes and censoriousness and cancellation and everything else that we know is going on. So he has to get that balance right, the balance between being edgy and being conformist, like the sort of Steven Pinker of stand-up comedy.
Yeah, I mean, in that one I watched earlier on, he has a whole bit about Josh Widdicombe. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Comedian, yeah, the ginger short guy. He's one of the panel show people.
He says, "Oh, you know, the one who goes on that comedy show for disabled people, you know, where they've got the guy in the wheelchair and so on." They never really mention what Josh Widdicombe's disability is. That's his joke. I mean, it's like it's quite an edgy joke if you think about it. But he kind of gets away.
Yeah. Well, the implication is that Josh Widdicombe's mentally retarded,
exactly. That's the kind of payoff, you know. So, yeah, I mean, he does walk a number of interesting...
That's this thing, that he's mocking those people, the panel show people that do things like that. But it's interesting in terms of his own psychology that he went through a period when he was desperate for money, really desperate, because he put all this money into Jerry Springer the Opera, and it had been destroyed by a fundamentalist Christian campaign and whatever.
Good show, that was all.
So I only saw it on TV. I never saw it. Did you see it live?
I went to see it live. Yeah, it was absolutely hilarious. Jerry Springer the Opera.
A chap I knew was in it. Actually, was an actor in it.
It was a superb takedown of modern consumerist culture and American culture and some of the worst excesses of individualism and so on.
It was one of the few times in recent years that the right has managed to cancel something.
It's honestly a bit of a shame because in many ways, the critique of American culture that show offered, you know, for all of the jibes of Christianity and so on, was pretty astute. I recommend people go back and watch that show. So anyway, carry on, Ed. Yeah.
Well, no, I was just, yeah, you can't, he, it was that, that it basically ruined him financially. And so he was compelled to be a panel show person. He was compelled in the wake of the collapse of that to go on to do what he was told, basically, which was by his agent, which was you will go on these panel shows because, like, Have I Got News for You or 8 out of 10 Cats or whatever, because you need the money. And that's what he did. And now it's very interesting that now that he doesn't need, now that he can, now that he's managed to sort himself out from about 2008 onwards in terms of stand-up comedy again, now he's mocking those very same people who are just doing what he sees himself, perhaps rightly, but what he sees himself as too talented and having too much artistic integrity to do. Mm-hmm. That when he needed the money, he absolutely deigned to going on to being a panel show comedian.
I mean, one of the other things that I find interesting about him, Ed, is his constant, and it's something that I've started, like, it's something I found myself doing myself as I've got a bigger audience these days and so on. Maybe it just comes naturally to me as a kind of misanthropist or whatever, but he constantly berates his own audience. He often takes time out to deconstruct the audience's reaction and then tells them off for not being clever enough to get his jokes. That, in fact, in the one I saw just now, in the tornado one, he tells a trigonometry joke, and then he starts saying, well, when I did this in Oxford, that was the bit that people laughed at the most. And then he started kind of, he just takes little moments where he starts like telling off the audience for comedic
effect.
It's
very good. It's very clever because it's this tension that it's unexpected. Well, it's not with him unexpected anymore because he has done it quite a lot. But as long as he doesn't do it too much, then it's a departure from the normal rhythm. There's a rhythm that builds up with the laughter and the build up of the jokes. And with him, okay, they're normally quite long jokes, so there's quite a lot of gaps between serious laughter, but it builds up in a certain way. And then this idea, it seems genuine. It makes it seem more genuine, even though, of course, it's not. And he has a go at Eddie Izzard for pretending to be spontaneous in one of his stand-up routines. But this is, of course, highly planned. He knows he's going to do this, I think, or at least a lot of the time. And so you depart from that, which then changes the tension level in the room, which then changes the rhythm in the room, which then creates tension. And that's part of, there's research on this, that's part of humour. Part of humour is this tension and the build-up of tension and the tension breaking due to incongruities or whatever.
I hate to get all... When I did my degree, I remember I studied at one point narratology, right? And they talked about the relationship, between the author and the audience, because any text has a speaker, right? An implied author. It's got the actual author you put to one side, then you've got the speaker, the implied speaker, and then his relationship to the audience. But then on top of that, you have, well, who is the implied audience? Like, when you're reading a text, who is it written for, right? And Stuart Lee plays with the different levels of, well, who is Stuart Lee the speaker, but also who is the audience? And on certain shows of his, he actually starts breaking down the audience. He's like, oh, these people over here. And he starts like deconstructing the different audiences in the audience. And then, of course, if a right-wing newspaper reviews the show, that's a different audience again. And he kind of plays with that stuff in a very interesting and knowing way, which is of interest to somebody like me, because
he creates what in anthropology would be called pseudo oppositions. So you can argue that there's this notion in traditional anthropology, this idea of communitas, this idea of a space that is apart. I think, what was the word? Comitatus, perhaps, a space that is apart from normal life. So if you go to, let's say, a rock concert or whatever, a stand-up comedy thing, you're in this space that is apart from normal life. And so the normal structures of normal life are kind of broken down a little bit. It's more acceptable, like in Freshers' Week at university or whatever, it's more acceptable to just chat to a random person who's next to you, let's say, than it would normally be, because you're in this special space where the normal rules don't apply. And it's suggested that when people are put in these liminal phases where they transpose from being, I don't know, a child to being an adult, then the pseudo oppositions are created deliberately to help to even further bring about sort of a social bonding process, which then even further helps to bring about bonding with the people in positions of authority because they are above the process. And all this relationship then between the comedian who you're bonding with, who you have a power relationship with, and the audience. And that's very interesting that he does that. He creates these pseudo oppositions where he'll say, oh, well, look, the people in this side of the audience, they don't understand it. They don't find it funny. They don't get this joke. But the people over here, they're different. They're of a higher caliber of people from Southend or whatever. And they get, but then there's the people up there in the balcony. I don't know what they're doing. You know, I think they're busy on their phones. He does that. No, I don't have seen any other comedian that does that. And it's very clever in terms of how you're understanding the dynamics of how to cause a crowd to create basically to bond with you.
Yes, the master of ceremonies. He also sometimes intentionally creates a kind of one of these conflicts between himself and the audience, where it's Stuart Lee versus the audience, which is an interesting. I mean, as a fan of pro wrestling, which is all about these kind of crowd dynamics and how you play with them, it is often fascinating to see how he builds these up and plays them off, and you know how the more he gets angry and berates an audience, the more they seem to like him and the more they laugh.
Haven't you found this yourself, Emo? On your stream or whatever, when people in the sidebar are pissing you off, or someone's and you can focus in on one of them and just start berating them. And I know that when I'm doing, and they like it, the audience like it, and they express that they do. They like the breaking character from the answering the questions, to me becoming faux livid with somebody because they've said something illogical. And then they feel like they're being told off like naughty schoolboys, and they seem to like it. It's a natural follow the leader evolutionary dynamic.
But it's also interesting how Lee as a comedian plays with that, because a lot of comedians, he doesn't come across as a man who wants to be liked, right? That's his persona, and yet he's got a way of controlling a room in that way. In an almost masterful way. I remember one night I watched those 70s comedians, like the working club comedians, like the Bernie Mannings and so on.
Yeah.
I remember one night I sat and watched one of those with my brother, and in fact I even did on my little secondary channel, I even did a thing on it once a long time ago. And a lot of the weaker comedians in that 1970s crowd had a lot of little kind of nervous tics where they kind of laugh at their own jokes, or they'd have a little thing they do to make sure the room was back on side. But you could sense the insecurity in them. You could sense that they were always worried about losing the room. Whereas Lee is just, I mean, he has got a masterful control over the room as just a kind of craft, like an ABC craft thing. I don't know of too many other stand-up comedians who have that level of mastery.
Someone like, it's almost like comparing Margaret Thatcher to Neil Kinnock. You know, someone once said that Neil Kinnock had some incredible highs in his parliamentary debating, but he also had quite just unbelievable lows where he would just be rubbish. And I think that's true of Richard Herring, actually. I find some of the things that Richard Herring has done funnier than anything that Lee has done. Some of the things that Richard Herring has done are brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But then there's other things that are just meh, and other things that are just not very good. He has brilliant highs but terrible lows, where it's just not funny, and he's losing the audience, and the joke isn't working. Particularly, actually, with some of the plays, I used to follow Herring as well, and there was a number of plays that he took to the Edinburgh Festival, his own plays. And they were, without doubt, in each case, just not very good. Whereas with Lee, there's just a certain level of competence.
And
he never falls below.
I wonder if part of the reason for that is because some part of Richard Herring wants to be liked. He wants to be liked at some like basic human level. He wants to be liked. He lacks the kind of autism of Lee, because I have never felt that like insecure need to be liked. I just don't care. I suppose in a way that's maybe one of the reasons that I've always kind of been attracted to Stuart Lee, because some aspect of his character I see in my own character, but also that truly, truly not caring of somebody who doesn't like
you. Yeah, I mean, when I first met you in London some years ago, you were incredibly grumpy. I was with you, Poe the person, her husband, and along you come, you were just so grumpy. And I was like, bloody hell. And it sort of wore off as we went to the art gallery, and then we went eventually found that Chinese restaurant pub place.
Yeah,
and you sort of perked up a bit, but you were just pissed off. And I was like, Christ almighty, he's very different in real life from on the YouTube. And the YouTube, he's interviewed me, he's been on my show, he's either mystery, he's a fun guy. I meet this guy, grumpy bastard, isn't he? So I
only picked up when we got to that, kind of decrepit, half pub, half Chinese restaurant, damp up the walls, kind of random, kind of bald-headed racists. It was amazing.
And then we're in this, just this revolting place, and then suddenly you cheer up. You're like, oh, yeah, actually, my life's not that bad. It could be worse. I could live around here. Perhaps that's true. I think there's an element of that. I think that he does come across Stuart Lee as a person who just does not care. And that's true with the research I've done on geniuses. I'm not saying he's a genius, that is for others to say, but they don't care. They just don't care. And it's the people that do care that either take ages to come up with their scientific brilliance because they're concerned about offending people. Charles Darwin is an example of that. He was not going to publish. And then because it would upset his wife.
Interesting.
And then when it, became, he was high in, he was relatively high in aspects of agreeableness for a genius. Not like Isaac Newton, who was just a nasty person and who therefore just didn't give a fuck about what anyone felt at all. But he delayed like 20 years because of his concern about the reaction. Particularly his wife was a very committed Christian and it would upset her and all this sort of thing. And then eventually when he realized that other people were kind of onto the same thing, then he published. And I think you might be right that Herring. I don't know. I mean, the only problem is that all with Lee, I've sat there and had a beer at the pub. In me and him were performing had our stop on at the same venue. I forget the name of the venue now, but it was this small venue in Edinburgh. And I had a play on that I'd written that had won a load of awards at Durham University. And I had this monologue that I'd written. I've written and directed it. Somebody else was the actor, and then he in the same theatre had his thing. So I got to go in for free to everything that was in the theatre that I had my play in. And this is August 01. And so of course then I got chatting to him, and the way he came across in chatting to him, when you see him in the just sort of jolly laughing guy, basically he didn't come across as introvert. He came across as just a fun, laughing, outgoing man who bought me a beer.
Interesting.
And equally, Jerry Sadowitz, who was influenced Lee. Once I sat with him at a bar in Edinburgh. Again, he bought me a beer. He came across as slightly more sweary, slightly more angry man. You know, he wasn't as fun. He was acerbic. He was cutting. He was less of the kind of person.
I actually did. Speak to Richard Hare. I've spoke because I do you remember he had the Leicester Square theatre thing that he did for a while.
Richard Hare. Vaguely, yeah.
I went to see. I at some point he had a podcast with Andrew Collings, which I listened to, and I think he did a Leicester Square show around that time, which I went to, and I brought a Fist of Fun CD there. And I bought his Hitler Moustache CD there, and spoke to him briefly, and he was just a bit kind of sweaty, and you know, he'd just been on stage and so on, so I didn't linger. But if I had to guess, I would say that Richard Herring is a slightly more agreeable character than Stuart Lee.
I think so, and I think that the characters that they played, the personas they played as part of Fist of Fun and Turumrunja were basically, they were exaggerations of themselves. And certainly Herring has talked about that, that the Herring character was a kind of his teenage self, exaggerated. And of course, there's the one sketch they do about, who were those two hostages that were held together in Lebanon or something for years and years and years? Keenan and McCarthy, was that their names?
They did
a sketch on this about how they both subsequently published memoirs about what happened. And one of them was, and that was the one that was read out by Lee, was just this miserable, depressive, pessimistic person. And the other one was just this jolly, porridge for dinner again. Ho hum. Yeah, it's completely the other. It's life is just pointless. Smell of death is around me. It's meaningless. I can't wait to die. The other one's like, porridge for dinner. Ho hum. Oh well. Oh, honestly, my Selma. He's such a grumpy person. And they're, again, they did that because of the way that they're playing these exaggerated versions of themselves, which is less true, I think, with Lee. All I can say is that when I met Lee, he was much more the sort of, when you see him in the interviews, he's not this cynical character.
No, he definitely dials it up for the character, you know.
Yeah. Whereas with Herring, he just seems to be much more genuine, and he tries in some of his stand-ups that I've seen when he had attacks right-wing people or whatever, he tries to come across with the sort of Stuart Lee acerbic nastiness, and it fails. I think it just fails. It is not him.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I would say that Herring's solo material is more hit and miss than Lee's. I don't think I've ever seen a Stuart Lee show that I haven't liked. Whereas I've definitely seen Herring shows where bits fall flat and things like that. So, although none stick in my mind at the moment. Because they weren't that memorable, I suppose.
There was a deconstruction that Herring did of the hymn All Things Bright and Beautiful in one of his DVDs, which I have somewhere from about 2007 or 6 or something, and it's just rubbish. And he just goes on, and it's not funny. The basis of it is not funny, and it's just really poor. So yeah, that certainly sticks in my mind.
There are some early Lee stand-ups that I recommend people seek out that I remember watching some years ago. There's one where I think it's called Pea Green Boat, where he. Basically the whole show is like a deconstruction of the nursery rhyme, you know, the owl and the pussycat. Like the whole show, that's all the show is about the owl and the pussycat, and he just spends an hour kind of deconstructing it slowly. And that's one of the more unusual comedy shows you'll ever see, that one. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but
I'm not sure. I might have seen clips from it. I feel like
there's only an audio recording, and I listened to the audio recording of it. I don't think there's any footage of it, but that's a more obscure one off the beaten path that I would recommend people try to track down. Ed, we have reached the end of the hour. Is there anything else about Stuart Lee or about Richard Herring or about Lee and Herring that you want to mention?
Yes, but we can save that perhaps for another day, because we've reached the end of the hour, and we don't want to do a Richard Herring and make it too long and meander around and whatever. We want to keep it clean and tight and whatever, like a Stuart Lee.
That was the
Lee's comedy vehicle.
That was the old Monty Python trick. If you ever notice, Monty Python sketches often run out of steam and they kind of lose interest in themselves. And Monty Python's way of dealing with it was just a segue to another sketch without a payoff, without any punchline. They do that a lot, Monty Python. So
segue from here to the Jolly Heretic tomorrow night at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York. I'll be interviewing Helen Dale about being a high IQ woman. You can segue to that.
And now for something completely different, Helen Dale. I met Helen Dale once. She's a towering woman, you know, much taller than I am. In fact, I met her a couple of times, but on the first occasion that I met Helen Dale, she was there. You know, she must be about 6 foot tall or something. She's really big. She's kind of big, and she looks like she'd take you in a fight as well. And I was just trying to, like, play it a bit cool and be like, oh, you know, it would be nice if we had some freer markets, perhaps. She was just full on like, yeah, wouldn't it be good if we just lived in kind of a eugenic Roman period where they just killed disabled children? I was like, fucking hell. So she was extremely hardcore that time I met her. I don't know if she'd been drinking or whatever, but...
Okay, well, hopefully I can get her drunk on the Jolly Heretic. And
she was surprisingly based on that occasion.
Well, her boss manifesto will will come out.
Do by course is the academic agency, of course. Join the Substack, join Jory Heretics Substack as well. Yeah. And for those of you who will be at the event this weekend, I need to write my speech tonight. I'll see you on Friday. But for now, it's important that everybody gets out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easy.